What's up, y'all? This is part two of a multi-part episode. So if you have not heard part one yet, then by all means, go back and listen to part one, which should be the previous episode, before listening to this one. And if you have listened to part one, then by all means, go ahead and enjoy what's to come. And here we go. Yeah, so I think that's kind of a big problem happening. When you see Hillary Clinton talk, it sounds very focus group tested. It sounds very safe and playing both sides of everything. And what I'm not crazy about, all of Bernie Sanders' takes race. Sometimes, like with the reparations, I would like him to be a little more direct. But I will give him credit in that the things that he's always stood for, he still stands for.
Amen.
He has been consistently socialist. And before the nitpickers come, because there's some people that are like, he's not socialist. He's actually a social... Yeah, he's actually a social democrat.
Like, yeah, okay, fine.
You know what I mean. Like, compared to the centrism, you know.
I think he and AOC and even Cardi to a point, and even, I throw in Desus and Mero with this. I think they are part of both cultural and political forces that helped to push the proverbial Overton window leftward. And Desus literally will openly talk about Jeff Bezos has how much money? Oh, he's got to go. Somebody's got to kill Jeff Bezos. He literally will just like say this shit as a joke. it's kind of amazing that there's anyone in this country even saying that as like a hot take joke. Like, I think that's kind of fucking incredible. We live in a time where that's even remotely acceptable.
I've never seen Desus and Mero. Are they?
They're amazing, dude.
Pretty political.
Incidentally. Like they more get into the personalities, and like Desus has like shouted out DSA on the podcast and shit like that. Like they obviously have like very left politics, and Mero has said like anti-imperialist shit. Like incidentally, and they're about as political as often as they are like serious, which is basically never. But like every once in a while they very clearly like open the window or like sort of take off the mat, like lift the mask up, you know. But it's all just mostly, it's just like, you know, Breakfast Club type, messy shit. Like, that's what I listen to.
Yeah. I know they're pretty popular.
Yeah. They're getting there. They're getting there, man. They're great.
So tell me, what are your politics if you had to, describe them?
I would say I'm fine with the socialist label, but I'd say more broadly, leftist, for sure. I'm a member of DSA, all white dudes with beards and glasses like me are contractually obligated to do. but I'm also a member, I'm from Florida, and I'm a member of an organization called Dream Defenders, which is a multiracial organizing group that you may know of, for their actions around the Trayvon Martin murder and how they... the beginning, if I can just start with a really quick beginnings of the organization, they marched to the Sanford police station and surrounded it and said, you got to arrest the Zimmerman dude. And from there, after Zimmerman was acquitted, they went to the Capitol, occupied the Florida Capitol, where I'm from in Tallahassee, for about 30 days. At the time I was pretty familiar with it and went and, you know, gave them food and just kind of wished them well on that sort of sit-in, if you will. When they started doing events in Tallahassee around the time of Andrew Gillum's gubernatorial run, which was very, very exciting, he had sort of a vague Beto kind of effect down ballot in Florida, kind of the way Beto did in Texas a little bit, where I think he inspired a lot of grassroots enthusiasm. And there was some good to it. He just barely didn't win, but Amendment 4 did pass, which is good. And it's that him almost winning and the Amendment 4 passing that I think Dream Defenders, I think we're the leaders of Dream Defenders, the strategists of the organization that I'm a member of, I think they really see a people power opportunity. with that in the state of Florida. And as you know, the state of Florida is just entirely screwed up, as we all, as I think the whole nation knows. There's been some encouraging recent criminal justice reform in Florida. Obviously a long way to go. I think the whole coalition that Dream Defenders is in understands that. We have a manifesto called the Freedom Papers that I would encourage everyone to check out. It's a beautiful, beautiful read. It's a great manifesto. And if you're interested, if you live in Florida, and especially if you're in South Florida, there's lots and lots of opportunities to get involved. So there's that. I'll give that plug. That's the only real plug I got.
About having you on is that I feel like your views don't perfectly overlap with mine. Mm. So I think it's interesting because we get to talk things out, feel things out. But I feel like you come from it in a way where you honestly want to do good, you know, and I think that makes for better conversations. Because one thing that I feel a little bit on the fence about, I'm not sure about if woke hip hop, and I say this as somebody who used to really believe in woke hip hop, but when I was coming up, there was a stage where a lot of hip hop was woke, but then what kind of ended up happening was it turned into a fashion. So it just became like these medallions, these sayings, these things. And then what made it dangerous was when a new fashion came along, which was gangster rap. And this is not to disparage gangster rap or anything as a genre, but people just adopted those new trappings as easily as they adopted all the Afrocentric woke stuff. And I just kind of feel like we need to kind of focus more on a real political program for Black people that the music can then take the lead of, rather than the politics kind of looking to the rappers. Because I feel like that kind of hasn't been working recently.
Well, number one, let me say off the rip that, like, far be it for me to like say or act like anything prescriptive, because all I'm trying to do is like just not be part of the problem. I'm just trying to be like a not shit white person, honestly talk. Like, that's all I'm trying to do. Yeah. And on top of that, being Jewish, I think it's actually really important to be part of like two BDS organizations. Both DSA and Dream Defenders are both very strongly in favor of Palestinian human rights. I think that's incredibly important. I've been to Israel. I've seen Gaza from afar. It shook me to my core. It's a very important personal experience for me as a Jewish person. In the Taliesin Core group, we have two other white Jewish folks who feel similarly. And I think it's really important for BDS or BDS-friendly, you know, organizations to have Jews in them, if only as like optics political cover, if you will. Yeah. If only as that, but more than that, from a genuine place of Jewish, Palestinian, Arab, Black, whatever, solidarity, as just this idea of, hey, we get that the system's set up not just for just against like Black folks or brown folks or whatever, but it's set up for just really all of us, like people, just everyday ass people, like on some level. So like, so that said, I do think that in all messaging, and I see this with Dream Defenders, you can't just like talk theory. You can't just talk over people's fucking heads. Like, you can't just like have this barrage of like multisyllabic, like super intelligent, woke, conscious like words and just blah, 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 at people, and they catch every fifth syllable or whatever the fuck. Like, you're not going to reach people that way. You're only going to preach to the choir. Maybe don't do that. I think the way maybe someone like Kendrick is, you know, quote unquote woke, but he's still like relatable and still talks his shit or whatever. I think that's cool. Like, that appeals to me at least. And, or even like the way Boots is like funny and goofy and still is a bit of an everyman, but he still has very, very radical politics. I appreciate
that. One thing with Boots, he seems so politically active that he almost seems unfair to keep in the entertainer category, because yeah, he actually has a lot of political volunteering, a lot of grassroots work. So he kind of almost is both in one. So same way some people are like writer directors, he's kind of like a
Well, he's literally a writer activist. And director.
Yeah. He's literally a writer director, but he's like an activist artist. Yeah. You know, which
artivist, as some people call it, which is stupid, but whatever.
It works though. It's kind of catchy.
It's fine. It's a brand or whatever. But it is interesting. I think anyone can understand that, right? Like, you have to just talk about, like, the regular party and bullshit, to quote Big. Like, you have to talk the party and bullshit, but then, like, in the mix of that, you throw in that little bit of, let's party while we can. You know, that those kinds of, like, stakes, right? I think that's really important. It's a delicate thing to strike, dude. Like, and I don't have any answers on like how exactly to do that. I think someone like Kendrick is good at that. I think someone like Boots is good at that in different ways. But far be it from me to be like prescriptive about that shit, because I don't fucking know.
Yeah, like one thing that kind of Kendrick had that song where he was talking about, he was calling himself a hypocrite.
Mm. I'm the biggest hypocrite of 2015 or whatever. 16.
Yeah.
And that is so important.
Yeah.
To not
seem
holier than thou.
Yeah. But he called himself a hypocrite, right? And I didn't want to get too mad at him because I thought he was coming at it from a good place. But when he said, like, he was kind of, the song was kind of, what about black on black crime? I'm a hypocrite. I think there's a place for that conversation, but I was kind of annoyed that he didn't put it in a more broader systemic context. What I used to like about some of the older rap songs like Self-Destruction and stuff, there was this kind of idea where, yeah, we have to stop black on black crime. Like Self-Destruction was that posse cut that KRS-One organized about stop black on black crime. But the rest of KRS-One's body of work was also talking about white supremacy. So when you talk about the interpersonal, intra-racial aspects that were happening in the black community, he was, in the larger body of his work, putting it into the context of hundreds of years of subjugation and slavery. So part of the reason why we're shooting each other like this or doing all this stuff is because we've been kind of subjugated, trained to hate ourselves, do all this stuff. And as much as I like the intentions behind that Kendrick song, it never kind of rose behind this kind of vacuum of just black people. A friend of mine made this very good analogy. I can't take credit for it, but it's my friend Teen from the podcast Escape from Plan A. But he was talking about the movie Secret Life of Pets. And have you ever seen Secret Life of Pets?
I can't say I have. I'm curious where this is going.
it's a weird movie, right? But the movie Secret Life of Pets, there are these pets, right? There's this world of the pets where the pets don't realize they live in the world created and run by humans. So the pets think it's just their world, and these humans are just kind of like these accoutrements or these almost like they own the humans, or the humans are just these ancillary things. Like, for example, in their world, a fire hydrant is a bathroom. They don't understand the broader, bigger purpose of a fire hydrant, you know? Right, and right. So they have this whole pet world that is not informed by the context of humans at all. Outside of humans, it's just these things that come in and walk them and give them food. They almost think like the humans almost like serve them. What Teen said was very interesting was he was saying like a lot of these black movies or Asian movies will present a world where, like, say it's like an all black American movie, or the movie we were talking about was the movie You'll Always Be My Maybe, this Asian American rom-com. Yeah. And he was like, it's an enjoyable movie, but they're pretending they don't live as a minority in a majority white world, you know?
No one ever went broke on escapism. I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Of some form, I mean, or another, right?
Exactly. So it's like, it's different than if you watch a rom-com made in China. Because in the Chinese movie, they're living in a Chinese world. Like, they're in a Chinese country. You know, like, they're in that Chinese society. When You'll Always Be My Maybe is in a small part of Chinatown in San Francisco, and you're not bringing up that Chinatown is shrinking because capitalism is shrinking it, you know, and that in America, an Asian American male is kind of stereotyped, not masculine, or there's all this stuff going on. You just kind of create this vacuum. He was saying it's kind of like Secret Life of Pets. You just, the escapism. I feel like that's where a lot of hip hop politics is now. Like, it's not being informed by the broader world that we live in.
It's not realist.
Yeah,
real politics, yeah.
Yeah, Kendrick is talking about how black people treat each other, but not talking about the conditions that have them shooting each other. And that's kind of what's bothering me, this whole Secret Life of Pets thing, where we're just acting like, Jay-Z's saying gentrify your hood. Like we're in this all-black world where black people can just, a black businessman can just buy up his block. What white bank is going to give him the loan, you know?
Rick Ross can talk about, like, buy back the block or whatever, and he can he can talk his shit or whatever, but, like...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. If I can psychoanalyze a lot of what Kendrick has done for a second.
Yeah.
Kendrick, well, before the psychoanalyzing, I'll just say like some basic music writer shit, which is so much of his point of view in his lyrics is like impressionist. It's the world through his eyes. Like Secret Life of Pets is through the world through the pet's eyes, right?
Exactly.
It's like kind of an impressionist thing. But more than impressionist, I kind of think Kendrick is the type of dude, again, this is purely from his lyrics. I don't know what kind of dude he is. But if I were to psychoanalyze him through his lyrics, I don't know. I'd say he almost like is the type that just internalizes everything. Like it's on me. It's my fault. It's what this means to me. It's what can I do about this kind of thing. It's one reason I've always related to him. I react very much the same way, just sort of off the rip about almost anything I hear about in the world. So I wonder if that plays into the whole, we got to stop slitting each other's throats kind of thing.
I think it does.
Okay.
And I think it's even an admirable stance to take because you have to look at your individual contributions. I guess my problem is that's not really something you can build politics on. Politics has to eventually take the structural, take the communal. I mean, like, because politics is about what can groups do? What can interest groups do? What can coalitions do?
Collectivist politics, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can't just do this politics, which is why I think is another neoliberal aspect.
Yes.
A lot of neoliberal aspects of things comes from this idea that if I improve the fuck out of myself and all of us just do this personal project, then as a group, we're going to improve. If all of us just meditate, if all of us just read the right books, if all of us just
pray in the next room for sick people at a hospital.
Exactly. Thoughts and prayers.
And by the way, I just want to note, not to like throw a wrench in the works here, but there are studies that actually prove collective prayer does, like, however incidentally, can actually work to get chronically ill people well. But I don't know. That's probably still bullshit. But like, but it is interesting, right? This whole idea of whether it's prayer or whether it's meditation or whether it's self-wellness or like whatever.
And to be clear, I'm not all or nothing with this. I'm not saying that.
Right.
I'm saying the personal does play a role, you know, just,
yeah,
it shouldn't be everything.
Yeah, you're right. But but I do think if you don't frame politics collectively, what you're ultimately doing is just treading water. I mean, really,
yes, you know, exactly.
It's like with green politics, with like environmentalists, you know, climate change politics, your individual consumption means fucking nothing. It mathematically, it is infinitesimally so fucking small compared to literally any oil and gas company.
Yes.
You know,
and I'll even spread it to your individual behavior, like the individual consumption falls under behavior, which not to say it doesn't matter, but it's, you can't build a revolution just around that.
Or even 1,000 people doing a boycott of a certain thing or a certain company, it That's not even pissing in the ocean. I mean, that's it's so infinitesimally small. You got to think bigger, and you got to think more collectively in every step of the way. People will always ask, like, "What can I do?" But then your response, I think, every time should be, "That's the wrong fucking question." The response is, "What can we do? Talk to your fucking neighbors." It starts with that. It starts with get to know your neighbors. It starts with talk to your coworkers about real shit. You know, like it's like stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like
fundamental reframing.
I feel like the music from back in the day that worked as anthems or theme songs or whatever was being informed political thinkers. People were kind of staying in their lane. Like Mahalia Jackson was in the audience of the I Have a Dream speech, and she was kind of calling from the back, you know, telling Martin, like, talk about the dream, talk about this. But she kind of knew that that was Martin's stage to take the lead on. Whereas I feel like now, who is the Martin? Like, someone like Obama is like a manager. He's someone trying to think of what kind of deals he's going to strike on Wall Street or with Netflix when he's done, you know, or whatever. And I think we're almost unfairly asking too much out of the rappers to do this kind of political heavy lifting.
You're right.
That I don't blame them for. Like, I'm not, like, I want to make clear, I'm not blaming Kendrick. That dude's been working on his music and living his life. Like, you don't get to be a rapper that talented by studying politics all day. You know, he's working on his craft. I feel like we need a better radical and black politics. But what I like is, it's happening. Like, say what you will, but like the things you describe with the Dream Defenders and all this stuff and these people who are really engaged and really trying to get people to take notice. Like, my hope is that we get rappers who are looking at people like that, getting educated by that. You know what I mean?
Well, we've got a mixtape coming out this summer. I don't know if that's embargoed or not, but we've got a...
Oh, really?
Yeah, a mixtape coming out. I want to say it's July or August, but I don't know when this is even coming out, but you can cut it out if I'm not supposed to say anything.
Let me know.
Yeah, yeah. But July, August, we've got a mixtape of like Florida rappers coming out. I don't know how political all the content's going to be. I still have to hear it, but that is something we're doing, and we have sort of like a partner studio in Miami that we work
with. But that synergy is great.
The synergy is great.
Yeah,
it's something that movements need, and like I was saying before, it's like every movement has had its theme music. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
It's really exciting to be a part of an organization like this. I'm really just getting started, getting this Tallahassee squad like built up, and to get us really mobilized for a new police station that's supposed to be built for our local police department. You know, like we're dealing with like the most hyper-local of like local issues and stuff. But it's, you know, it's an exciting thing to be so supported by the staff who's got like big, you know, these bigger visions and these bigger plans, including like that mixtape.
I think theme music is a good analogy because I feel like the theme song and the theme music, that person is not supposed to be the person who's actually dictating the content of the show. He's supposed to be working with or she is supposed to be working with the writers of the show or making sure that the theme music reflects the content. Like, you know, like you don't write the theme song first and then try to build a show around that. And that's what the mixtape concept, what makes it sound so good. It's like, it's something where the theme songs are being kind of crafted around the movement. You know what I mean?
Movement first. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll pass it off to you about your thoughts on this. Like, you were talking about prescriptions for hip hop. Like, what are your prescriptions?
And my lack of them, just to be clear.
Okay. And your lack of them. Because that's kind of been like where I've been stuck on, where I feel like these rappers kind of need someone political to really kind of help guide the theme songs that they're trying to craft. And if they had that, you wouldn't have these weird gentrify your hood moments by Jay-Z.
Mm. I don't know. I think part of the reason the reaction to Nipsey Hussle getting murdered was so strong is that Nipsey Hussle was like a future, you know, a future elder statesman. Yeah. It was really just, I mean, gutting. I mean, I don't have words. It's just so horrible. And him and Freddie Gibbs, I think both are really good examples of balancing, I don't know, political and gangster rap or whatever, of a certain balance in that West Coast vibe. Like, I think they're like dope, dude. They were, you know, RIP, you know. I also think like Run the Jewels is a really interesting example of being political and then also just creating like just grimy gangster shit.
A great thing about Run the Jewels, what I like about Run the Jewels, Killer Mike has kind of put his foot in his mouth on a lot of things. But yeah, but what I like about him is he's kind of done the dialectical. Like he's That's let true. Himself be corrected.
True.
And admitted he's wrong.
The NRA TV thing was so fucking weird and fascinating.
And there were some other things, like just last week, he kind of...
Oh, I got to hear about this. All right, what's
yeah,
up?
Yeah, he kind of admitted that he was wrong about something. Like, he said something. I can't remember what it was, but some people kind of checked him, and he was like, hey, I just read up on this, and you guys are right. I'm going to do more reading on this.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, me
because
too.
Because we're all on some bullshit sometimes. Like, and I think that's... I think that the number one thing that put people off from any political artist or any political anybody is the holier than thou thing, like I said earlier. And I think it's really approachable and chill and like both an artistic aesthetic and a political tone to just be like, hey, yeah, like we hashed it out. And yeah, you know what? Maybe you're right. Like, I'm going to rethink this.
Like, yeah,
that's
exactly.
So fucking refreshing. That's it was so really refreshing.
Yeah. And I wasn't crazy about his first stance. I wish I had it handy. But the fact that he was willing to work out his thoughts in public.
In public, yeah. So
out
it's
loud,
very important.
Yeah. And take feedback. You know, like that's what I think will lead to good hip hop and music politics in general. This idea that you don't have to dial down or be a know-it-all or, you know, get defensive when people try to hip you to stuff.
Yeah. And I think we live in a dialectical time. And I think we live in a time when bottom up thinking and top down thinking are like kind of constantly in friction, kind of. Social media is an ugly, weird, messy, and also beautiful thing with that. It's how we ended up even having this conversation. And it's with Twitter and everything. And, And every platform has a kind of a slightly different sort of dynamic. And it's really weird, interesting times we're in terms of bottom-up thinking and bottom-up grassroots movement versus this sort of autocratic presidency that we're experiencing and these rigged, gerrymandered, on the state level, like state legislatures. I've never seen a time where... At least, I mean, I'm 34, but like it's fascinating to be in a time when there's so much bottom up energy and at the same time so much clueless and prescriptive like top down pronouncement at the same time.
Yeah, this is one of the first times in my lifetime where I've really felt like I'm living in anything can happen time. You know what I'm saying? Like.
It's terrifying, but
yeah,
it's kind of great too.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, right? it's scary. I mean, I don't want to like, you know, if any undocumented person is listening to this and says like, well, I just feel scared, period. And it's like, yeah, that's valid. Like, I get it. And like, I see that, I should say. And, but at the same time, like Mi Gente is an incredible organization, and there's all these activists in like Chicana organizations in California that are like really stepping up, and these churches that are like housing people for months away from prying eyes of CBP and ICE. It's just incredible to see people step up. It is so hope inspiring. I'm getting emotional. Like it's an incredibly beautiful thing to see people power and people solidarity. It's a beautiful thing.
Now, I want to ask you, what is it like a white person both writing about hip hop and being part of an organization that led by black women? Like, has there been times where you being a white male has helped and times where it's hurt, both in the music writing and in the activism?
Those haven't necessarily overlapped, and I haven't written about hip hop like a ton, but... I will say I'm always a little, definitely more than a little cautious when it comes to writing about any black artist, because I actually think we're in a pretty good place in terms of music criticism, where there's definitely been markedly better representation now, which I'm encouraged by. still, most music writers are just like these nerdy, like white dudes or nerdy white chicks or whatever, which is like, you know, it's the representation obviously isn't where it needs to be. But I think there's more. There's this one music writer, I don't remember her name off the top of my head, a woman of color. And she said, you know, sometimes when you're, if you're writing a profile, if you're writing a think piece, a review, you got to recognize sometimes that you're not the person to write that thing. And it's hard for someone who prides themselves on being, you know, the every person, the person with always something eloquent to say, you know, snappy to say. It's hard sometimes to just like take that step back and go, okay, maybe this isn't the piece I need to write. And from a material point of view, it's tough to turn down that couple, you know, a couple $100 to like write that thing. And that's that is a material sort of like not, I don't want to say sacrifice, but it's like a opportunity you're turning down, sort of like just being real, like, and material. So
I know what you mean about that. Yeah. Like to give an example, it's not quite the same thing, but
okay.
There was an article that somebody kind of was trying to get me to write, but it was the kind of thing where it was about the legacy of American slavery and stuff. And I was thinking, as a black person of Caribbean descent, I don't really feel like I'm supposed to be writing about that. It was talking about traveling.
Wait, writing about what specifically? I'm sorry.
Well, writing about how the story had to do with the history of slavery and commemorating it in America. How a black person feels about differential treatment of other people's oppressions versus the oppressions. I mean, how America commemorates American slavery. Like, say, for example, America will be okay with, say, Holocaust memorials, which America is not as directly responsible for, but will act weird about the lynching memorial, right, which is a direct indictment of America for several hundred years.
The Bryan Stevenson stuff in like on Alabama and stuff like that. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And that makes me feel as a black person. And I was thinking, that's not really my history. I'm not really the person who should be writing that. You should be getting a descendant of American slavery writer to be doing that. And I remember thinking, like, that's like a good gig, though. Like, you know, they would fly me somewhere. They would pay me for it. It would be a lot of good exposure. But yeah. I was like, I feel like I can't take it. So I'm like, I get what you're saying with that. Like,
on some level, yeah. It is kind of the same thing, though, from a class sort of material sort of economic lens. I mean, it is kind of the same thing. I mean, we you and I guess both, are these sort of subjects and serfs or whatever of like this gig economy, the specific sort of gig economy, this specific sort of gig economy. And it's all just sort of like write it in, like get to me in like 24 hours. I've had to turn over like sprawling features in like less than 24 hours. And like, it's just sort of gross. And it's no wonder that like rando writers either go viral and get stanned or get canceled, because so much is just like nothing's edited. Like nothing's fucking, that's the real horrible sad truth about most online journalism. Very little is actually like edited.
Because it's all click based. You have to just move on to the next thing right away. I was one of those people that really was against clickbait, and then somebody put it in a way that I realized, like, wow, I'm one of the people who's at fault, where they said, everybody hates clickbait, but nobody wants to pay for journalism. You expect everything free.
Boom.
And when they said that, I was like, wow, that's true. Like,
well, can I, this is interesting. I read about this moment in Pitchfork. I was at South by Southwest, my second time at South by, I want to say it was like 2014. I remember I met these guys from this band, I think it was Mansions on the Moon. I think I remember it very specifically. They had worked with Pharrell before. They got some notoriety. Good band. And these dudes were like loading stuff into a van to go to their like fifth show of the day or some shit like that. And I remember we were in this part of Austin that had a ginormous stacked stage. It mimicked a vending machine, and the sponsor was Doritos. giant god, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like these gross,
yeah,
like South by type brand activations, I think is the term,
yeah,
right? And it was the Doritos jacked stage, and it was these, and the brand ambassadors.
So funny. Was it Chester Cheetos or something?
This neoliberal hell. Oh god, I hate this so fucking much. It was these jacked up dudes wearing like muscle tees and with Doritos jacked, and they were like carrying on giant boxes of Doritos. It's just the dumbest shit you could possibly think of. And so anyway, we saw this madness. We saw this neoliberal hell. We were kind of both in this weird moment. We were strangers. We didn't know each other. I didn't even introduce myself as a journalist, I don't think. I wasn't even telling them I was quoting them. But it was just this really wonderful, eloquent moment where one of the members said to me, he looked at it and he said, you know what, dude? This is what happens when people don't pay for music.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, isn't that great? I swear to God, that was an actual genuine moment where he actually was that deep in the fucking moment. It was beautiful.
No, it's so true. Like,
it's so true.
This idea of everything being free has led to this sideshow. Like, you know, for example, after I read that quote about like, you can't complain about clickbait journalism if you're not paying for anything. I was doing my usual monthly thing of trying to get my 10 free New York Times articles. And then
you gotta switch browsers.
Yeah, switch browsers. Yeah, yeah. And then find workarounds.
Like cookies. So
I broke down. I'm like, you know what? Every month I hit my limit and I spend all this time trying to get free articles. Let me just pay whatever New York Times asking.
Fucking thank you.
But you know what's funny? It was only $1 a week. I didn't.
For the intro, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No. It was just, if you're just doing online and you're not getting a subscription,
yeah.
Like if all you want to do is just read New York Times online articles, it's just $1 a week. I was so keyed in to being free and getting around shit, I never even got to the point where I saw what the price it was. Like the price that I'm trying to avoid. You know
tripping,
what I'm saying?
Tripping. Yeah. Totally like, driven. Yeah.
I'm like, it's not even that bad. It's like $1. So now I read all the unlimited New York Times articles I want online for a whopping $4 a month. And I bet if a ton of people did that, it would.
Well, a ton of people kind of are already doing it. Thank God. I mean, yeah. If any, you know, it's funny. I mean, people wring their hands all the time about Trump demonizing the media. Bryan Cranston just recently on the Tonys were talking about like the media is the problem. Demagoguery is the problem, right? And it's okay, fine, that's true. The media, it's not like, you know, certain little niches of the media don't demagogue, but that's a different issue. But Trump demonizing the media has actually made a lot of people finally realize, oh, wait, we have to make sure the Fourth Estate is okay.
That's a good point.
It's really, thank you. And that's why the New York Times, just before Trump was elected, and the Washington Post, after Trump was elected, have 1 million paid subscribers online, which is not nothing. And the fact that like.
So it actually has led to a jump in.
A boost. Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
The stock price and everything. I mean, like.
I mean, the way things are going in media, every little bit helps. I wouldn't take any of it for granted.
Yeah, but then you have those, you know, smaller cities like, I mean, New Orleans just recently, for example, I was just there. I covered Jazz Fest. The one real solid, the one consistent piece of music journalism I even still do now that I have time for is I cover New Orleans Jazz Fest every year. The 50th anniversary was just in April, May. It was a great gig and it was an amazing thing to cover. I met like George Wayne, the, you know, guy who founded it, and the Newport Folk Festival. And I met, I met some amazing New Orleanians and some amazing touring artists. And over the years, I've covered it for a long time, for about 10 years, and I've met some amazing people. It's an amazing gig. And also in New Orleans, this is why I was there, and it happened while I was there. The Advocate, their like more investigative paper, announced that it was buying the larger, what most people would think is the larger paper, the New Orleans Times Picayune. And they would merge and they would lay a lot of people off inevitably. And it's these smaller like papers that are becoming like, that used to have like three newspapers like 20 years ago or 30 years ago and now have one. And there's this term like news deserts, like food deserts, where there's just little to no actual news, like real original, like adversarial, like watchdogging kind of news.
You know, it's kind of weird. There's more media and news than ever, but less actual news. And what I mean by that is my mom is retired. She watches CNN or MSNBC all day long. Like, it'll just be on.
God bless.
She's not even really watching it. She just kind of leaves it as background. And when I go to her house, it'll just be on the background. And I kind of realized, like, wait a minute. Back in the day, there wasn't really 24-hour news like that. Or if there was, it was just one. It was CNN. There wasn't, like, 24-hour news thing. But they would just try to cram it with all types of news. Now there's, like, six 24-hour news things. And they're talking about the same two things. It's very weird how there's more media than ever and less topics, less actual news. And that kind of reminds me of a news desert too, where you get like a lot of noise, but it's the same three notes.
Yeah. I think if you're going to television, I mean, television is inherently a medium where anytime they cover anything, they ask, do we got good footage? Like, I mean, just straight up, every news producer, every control room operator, you know, or whatever, is asking, like, do we got good footage? How long is it? Can we do it as B-roll? Da, 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 da. I mean, today you probably heard about the helicopter that crash landed on the on that building.
I used to work in that building.
Oh wow, that's wild. I'm staying like 5 blocks north of that fucking building.
Oh wow,
it sounded like the fucking apocalypse with all the sirens and shit out there. I legitimately for a moment thought like, oh shit, is this what the first like 10 minutes of 9/11 sounded like? Like, oh fuck, like it really scared the shit out of me for like a half minute there.
That's fucking nuts.
It was really weird. And it dawned on me that what broke it to me was just Twitter. It was just some Twitter like moment, like trending topic or whatever. And
it's sad, but Twitter is better for news than news.
Yeah, and journalists are all over Twitter, man. Like, I mean, it's a networking and a work. It's network and work, like, tool for them. And, I mean, it's toxic, but Twitter's fucking great. it giveth it, it taketh away. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to say, because in true Champagne Sharks fashion, we kind of went all over the place. Mm-hmm. Spent a little too much time on Chance and R. Kelly. I want you to take this opportunity to, if you can remember, go to any aspects that you wanted to talk about that you feel like you didn't get to get to. Like, by all means, take the floor.
And by all means, you take the floor. I don't know what the fuck to do. You know, it's, I feel like so much what we were circling around with like neoliberalism and rap music and like I was gonna get a Hamilton diss in, but I'm gonna skip that. Nothing has been spilled on
Hamilton. It'll be very on brand.
Fuck Hamilton. I've seen it on Broadway. It's good, but fuck it. I feel like so much of what we were like circling around in terms of like balancing politics and you know, like relatable shit. I feel like struggle rap, like, has only been like a nominal thing in rap music. And I think the whole idea of like that's of like the struggle and you know, Bobby Womack samples and whatever the fuck. Like, I feel like that is a, if nothing else, if people take nothing else away from this, like listening to this, I hope that like they start just revisit more struggle rap, because like and like seek out more and like new artists doing it, because there's always artists doing it. But like the whole idea of like hey, like you're broke and can't pay your bills, I'm broke and can't pay my bills too, dude, like let's be like busters together. Like, yeah. I love that. Is such a warm, lovely, like cool solidarity kind of feeling that isn't even necessarily political. It's just like the blues. It's, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just like, yeah, man, I'm like, I'm broke off my ass too until my next check. So are you. Like, so let's just like hang out and drink beers and like just not just stay in. Like, I think that something like that is, it's not, it's apolitical, and yet it is so fucking political.
It's very interesting to me because I'm one of those people that loves that blues aspect, that struggle rap aspect. Mm. But there's a part of me that always thinks too, like, what if there was the solution genre that came after the blues, or solution to the struggle rap? And that I think is going to be very much harder to do. Like,
yeah.
Like, and I'm not isolating that to rap or the blues or anything like that. I think it's a broader societal thing where I feel like right now what we really need is the diagnostic. Like a lot of people just aren't even diagnosing shit.
But that's the blues.
Yeah, that's the blues.
Because people got the blues, dog.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
they're alienated and isolated.
They're alienated.
And we live in this austerity fucking world and we're like, where nothing works and everything patronizes you and you just feel like not a human fucking being.
I totally agree on that. Yeah. Like, I think
the more of that we get, the better. I really do feel that way.
I think not only do we not have the solution stuff, we've lost the diagnostic stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, we've lost. So we have to get back the diagnostic.
At minimum. That is just ground zero. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we've lost the blues. We've lost the struggle rap. It's all about aspirational, like neoliberal rap. The blues is dead. Or the blues is just like Blues Traveler or the Blues Brother theme thing where it's just like cosplay. It's not...
Yeah. As someone who was just at like Jazz Fest, I mean, blues is just very much like, bro, like the only festival that I've ever been to that sold CDs, that still sells fucking CDs, is like New Orleans Jazz Fest.
That's beautiful.
And it's so pure, right? It's so innocent. Yeah. Like, it's so cute. No, but like it is implicit in like all the blues stuff. And you're right that it's become basically purely a throwback aesthetic thing.
But I do want the diagnostic part to come back. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
At its best.
Struggle rap is like the closest thing we have now to like, and the soul samples and shit. It's kind of like the closest thing we have now to like modern day blues. But I wasn't going to bring this up. And I think I should at this point, because I think there is something I have not. I wish I could like write about it in like a coherent way. I wish I could think about it in a coherent way. But this is just pure gut sort of associative thing. And I want to bounce this off you. You tell me what you think. Okay. I think there is something, what you call the neoliberal aspirational thing. I think there is something, as small as it is, I think there is something genuinely liberatory to someone who's been broke their whole life to listening to like the fantasy that Future gives them, or something like that, or some rapper like that gives them. And for just a moment, they're feeling themselves and they're driving their car, blasting their music on a Friday night or Saturday night. And they're like, yeah, I'm free. They feel free, right? And they're not free, right? Materially, they are not even close. They're in their shitty little car with their like plug-in air freshener, whatever the fuck, and their little and their like things dangling from their rearview mirror. But they feel like, hell yeah, I'm like feeling myself, like I'm feeling this music, and like there's this moment of liberation, and even if it's just ephemeral, right? And I don't know, there's just something in. Even just like that Future song, Move That Dope, like the video is like 100% political. Yeah. And even in something like that buried, even in the most like what most people would call like ignorant ass like rap, there's something like, there's just an energy. There's an energy to be harnessed, right? There's an energy to be valued and respected there. And I wish more people, especially white folks, would respect it. And so I want to bounce that off of you. Like, do you think there is something, maybe a teeny tiny bit, grain of a bit liberatory, even in that like neoliberal aspirational, like dope boy or whatever kind of rap?
I think there's something liberatory about it to the point where it communicates something genuine. What I mean by that is like, for example, when you're doing this stuff, it just becomes caricature. Then I think it's almost kind of, let me back up a little bit. Okay. I think an exaggeration can have reality to it. Like sometimes it's like a harsh funhouse mirror where the exaggerated aspect of the mirror kind of reflects something real. And through the exaggeration helps to highlight something that you kind of needed to notice. You kind of needed it exaggerated for you to like actually process it.
A lie that tells the truth.
Exactly. So it's like, I think there can be a liberatory aspect of that stuff, even if it's not even technically realistic, if it's on some level related to something real So I agree with you there. Like, I think when you hear those big dreams that people are having in those rap songs, that escapism, it helps you understand what they're trying to escape from. It informs you about something. It only bothers me when I feel like you're not even, you're misleading people as to what's going on the ground. Like, you know,
it does feel almost like leading people into temptation or whatever, like the, to quote the Bible or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Like, cause like, I mean, I think about like Jeezy comes to mind, like that thug motivation shit. And like that, or Jadakiss talking about like, why don't we own our own music? Like this, why, like,
yeah.
Why don't we own our own music? Why can't people get their degrees in jail? Like, sometimes it like leads people astray, maybe for the most part, but like every once in a while, there's like they find the path just from just random, you know, just wildly kind of flailing.
On a side note with Jadakiss.
God damn it, there's something there.
Yeah. On a side note with Jadakiss, his brags are the most fucking interesting. Like, my bathtub lifts up, my walls do a 360. Like, it's ridiculous. It's almost like extra fun because there's no chance of mistaking it for reality. Like, you know what I mean?
I'm from the South. That's how I feel about Cash Money. Yeah. I think Cash Money is like, and Juvenile and like Birdman and Wayne. Like, I just feel like they're so intentionally over the top that it's like, you can't not like find a wink and a nod in this somewhere.
Exactly.
It's satirical to the point of, it's like, yeah, we know this is ridiculous. We know we're ridiculous, but it's like, get this money and just like, and like get yours. And like, but also know like, this is like ridiculous also.
Yeah, exactly. This is like, we're wearing the escapism on our sleeves.
Yeah.
So it almost renders it kind of harmless because there's no chance of you mistaking this for real unless you're just a total deluded person.
Sure. But I mean, but the delusion is tempting.
It is.
The delusion is tempting. And God knows, I mean, some people don't really stand for anything because they don't know what to stand for. So they'll kind of fall for anything.
That is true.
And to borrow from Lincoln. And I don't know. It's just like you can sort of write people off for being just sort of dumb or gullible or like whatever. And it's easy for us. We're privileged to the point. I don't know your whole your whole ass background, but I think we're both like pretty well educated. We both had like these certain kind of upbringings that got us ahead, like in the world, at least a little bit. And in terms of education, and, you know, we can't write off people who don't have the same education. And it's not necessarily even on us to educate them, but morals is a different conversation. Like the moral about like how the world should be, that's a different conversation than an intellect.
I'll even throw in a whole other level. I'll say in some ways that lack of formal education in some ways can be an advantage.
There's
You know, in some ways, like,
I agree.
I'm not going to do it to the point where I lionize not being educated because that would be kind of insincere.
Different kinds of education, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There is no doubt to me that there are some blind spots that being too educated can lead you to. And I see it all the time on fucking Twitter and Tumblr where people have talking pointed themselves or theoried themselves into losing common sense.
Just oblivion. Yeah. Just like you lost the plot. Lost in the sauce. Yeah. Yeah. No, totally.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's as if it, like, if it's online, as if it's not online, it doesn't happen. It doesn't exist.
Exactly.
If it's not on TV, it doesn't exist. And it's, if it's not immediately quantifiable and observable and analyzed, it doesn't exist. It's like, no, dude, that's not how the real world like necessarily works. Like, I don't know. It's just like you got to have some like real material grounding to like any theory, any practice, like, you know, like, yeah.
We're on the same page
on that. Yeah.
So thanks for joining us. This has been a lot of fun, Paul.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. And I'm glad this happened because I've encouraged people who are just like fans or like the show. If you have something interesting to say, you know, we'll shoot the shit. I'm glad you took us up on the offer, Paul, and we had
Just came over to this dude's house. Like,
yeah,
like,
for real.
I just like, hey, can I bring beer? And he's sure. Let's just shoot the shit and then like, drink beer and hang out. Like, literally, dude, just email him.
Yeah, exactly. If you have something interesting to say, you know, let's talk about it, you know. And also to Paul's friends, people he's working with, don't cancel him.
Don't cancel
me.
The
problematic stuff was all me. I own it. You know?
So, yeah. I'm canceled.
Don't cancel Paul. You know, I own it. It's me. You know, I'm used to being canceled.
He's a bad influence.
Yeah. So thanks again, Paul. And any last plugs, any articles, any websites? This is the time to do it.
Yeah, dreamdefenders.org. Please check out Dream Defenders, especially if you live in Florida, namely South Florida. There's lots of amazing opportunities with them right now. Fellowships, if you're already into the sort of activism tip. Fellowships, direct actions, lots of stuff is coming up with them that I think folks, especially in Florida, I think will be really interested in. And if you're not, it's a good organization to just follow on social media, The Dream Defenders on Instagram, Dream Defenders on Twitter. Great posts, great design, great sort of prose and poetry that they do. I think they're really great follows on social media. And check out the Freedom Papers on their website, dreamdefenders.org. Check that shit out.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us, and everyone, be good.